Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain and make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. And follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
Plus, you can always listen to all of our episodes, old and new, on the Broadway Podcast Network, iTunes, and Spotify.
Today's guest is one of the most celebrated directors working on Broadway and in the world of opera. His ability to breathe new, vigorous life into the classics, both plays and musical, without altering a line of text is inspiring to fellow artists and a cause for celebration amongst those diehard fans of the golden age of the American musical.
His works include The Light in the Piazza, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, The Bridges of Madison County, Oslo, To Kill a Mockingbird, and the revivals of Joe Turner's Come and Gone, South Pacific, The King and I, Fiddler on the Roof, My Fair Lady, Awake and Sing, and Golden Boy.
Please welcome to the show the first guest we've had here whose life was changed by the Olympics, Tony Award winner Bartlett Scheer. Bart, how are you today?
I'm very, very good. It's great to talk to you guys.
It's so nice talk to you. So tell us about the Olympics. How did the Olympics affect your career?
What people don't know is I was a young director working in San Diego. I might have been about 25 years old in 1984. And the Olympics were held in Los Angeles that year. And in that year, they had what was called the Olympic Arts Festival. The Olympic Arts Festival invited every great director in the world to come and produce pieces there. So I was able to see Giorgio Strehler, who was one of the greats of all time. I saw Tadeusz Kantor. I went on to do a thing with Tadashi Suzuki. Oh, was there. The RSC was there. Ariane Mnuchin was there. If you took the 20th century and you put into the 20th century, like, its greatest directors in the first two-thirds of it, they all seemed to show up at the Olympics that year. So you could go and you could see over the course of two or three weeks some of the great theater of, you know, of the last 100 years, all collected in Los Angeles within a two-week period. And I went to see that. I saw Strehler, Mnuchin, Kantor, RSC, Suzuki. I saw all of these artists. Became obsessed with both, well, with Strehler and Kantor. Ended up doing a dissertation on Kantor and really immersing myself in his work. For people who know him, we'll get into him later. And then, but it was one of those places where you could actually absorb all these influences at once.
And I just wanted to ask you about Kantor. What was it about that work specifically that ignited something inside of you?
Yeah, what I found most incredible about him was he had very different approach to what I call interpretive art and creative art. He made this very strong distinction between interpretive and creative. You know, if you have a pre-existing text and you're going to do a version of Cherry Orchard, or you're going to do a version of, you know, Guys and Dolls, you are interpreting the text. Whereas if you're a creative artist, you're actually helping build and make something new. He always had a lot of conversation about that. He was deeply experimental. He was influenced by painting, and he developed an entire avant-garde approach to the question of how you create in the theater. And the pieces were extremely riveting and incredible and interesting. And they opened my head up to what I had been doing as a director, to a new way of thinking about what I could do.
And what was your style like prior to this experience?
Well, first of all, I with all due respect, I reject the word style.
methodology, because, process?
I had been directing maybe 5 years up to this point. Mm-hmm. I started not long before. I was building a theater in San Diego. I was doing all the things you normally do. I had seen the RSC stuff. I had grown up going to ACT in San Francisco. I loved the classics. I was doing some new plays. I was doing the normal things you do, even what people would normally consider basic directing. Cantor is not like any of that. And his way of thinking is completely different. And there are books you can read about him, and you can see some of his stuff online, but it's very radically different. And it was good to just open up my head to different thinking about, and I don't see myself as experimental in the way he is, but I do think that it's your job when you make, when you're a good director, to be both familiar with all of the history of the work, plus willing to push ahead into something very new, and on this balancing act between, you know, the traditional and the new. And that means in terms of ideas, in terms of perception, in terms on every level, you're always trying to push between those two things.
When did you first fall in love with directing?
I started in college. I wrote plays, one or two of which were actually produced. And I enjoyed writing plays. But when I got out of college, I went to my high school and they had a job for somebody to teach English. I was an English major, and they told me I could run the drama department, and I had never directed anything. So I said yes. And they gave me a theater with a bunch of kids to do it. I was 21, 22 years old, and I took on the theater and I just started directing. The first show I directed was 10 Little Indians, the Agatha Christie murder mystery. It was incredibly good. I rewrote the ending. I had a great time. It was really good.
What did you do to the ending?
I changed the ending back to what it is in the original book from the play version.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So I didn't rewrite Agatha Christie. I just sort of reshaped it a bit.
The plays give it a little happier of an ending, so that's good that you went back to that.
I don't think my ending was happier, actually. Yeah, the play is happier. Yeah. The book is not as happy.
That's no, correct. It's a fabulous book. Fabulous book. Yeah. And so you grew up in San Francisco, is that correct?
I did, in the 60s and 70s, yeah.
How did that culture of San Francisco in that time period affect
I grew up in a lot. I had this weird mixture, and one of the things may draw me to Cantor is, you know, my mother was Catholic. I was in a big Catholic family with seven kids, and my father was Jewish, although I didn't know that at the time. He had been born in Lithuania in a shtetl and emigrated, but he was very assimilated. And my parents met at Stanford, and my dad wanted no one to know he was Jewish. He wanted to do well in business. So we grew up in this family, this Catholic family, going to all Catholic schools, but I had this very sort of deep Jewish background that I didn't know about till I was about 14.
Oh my God.
And that was good. I think that's a good way to learn, because you're really ready to know what it means when you learn it that way. And San Francisco was there because I had a lot of older brothers and sisters. It was very, very tumultuous time socially, politically. I lived not far from the Haight-Ashbury. Things were very out of control. There were, you know, riots in the streets. You know, we lived in a middle-class sort of neighborhood at the time. You know, and new cops, you knew the firemen, you knew everybody, but it was changing radically. I had one older brother was at Stanford, where it was pretty out of control, and one older brother was at the Naval Academy. Oh. And so the two of them were very different. And the big thing in our family was, was a love of the Grateful Dead, which is not something you hear in most Broadway podcasts.
This is a first for us.
as a kid, like 11 or 12 years old, my brother took me and my twin brother, I have a twin brother, and we went with them to concerts at Winterland Arena, where the Grateful Dead put on these highly experimental free-form concerts. And that was my introduction to theater. It was purely Dionysian in nature. It was very wild. I wasn't doing drugs. I wasn't, you know, I just was watching this thing unfold with live light shows and everyone experimenting with drugs and watching this whole thing unfold without a real strong sense of rules. And it was a really great introduction to what theater could be. And they were highly experimental. Like, they would do their sets without any, you know, they would start in one place and just play. They'd experiment. Mm-hmm. They'd do transitions of their own. So I was kind of being introduced to to my own version of experimental music alongside that. Plus, I grew up in San Francisco, where I, as a kid, would go to ACT, and Bill Ball was doing great productions of Taming of the Shrew and amazing other work. I saw some great Moliere, some great stuff in high school. And the city was changing and full of transformation. And I, similarly, my parents were divorcing And so that created its own level of chaos. So we're kind of on our own. And my stepfather happened to be Chinese Hawaiian. So I had suddenly a whole Chinese side of my family. So it was quite a big mix.
Yeah.
That when I think now, when I have kids, none of the rules about keeping them safe or interest. I mean, it was like none of that was on. We were just free range and all on our own, and chaos. Crazy shit was happening.
Yeah.
Was your family supportive when you said that you wanted to make this a career?
Of my six brothers and sisters, none of them are in the arts. So I think in the early days, you know, when I was teaching in San Francisco and directing plays, they thought it was quite fun. And when I went and moved to San Diego to build a theater and to kind of start my own thing, I think they always worried, but I was very enterprising and very on my own anyway. So I just figured it out.
What was the impetus to start your own company?
I had friends in San Diego and they wanted to build a space. They were teaching at the University of California, San Diego. So I just went down there and built one. I was, you know, reading a lot of stuff and trying to figure out what it meant to make theater. I had done it. I had essentially my own company when I was, you know, teaching.
Yeah. Because
I had all these students and we could do what we wanted. Mm-hmm. That's where I did my first musical. I did Working. That was my, I picked that as my first musical to do there. And I did the first play I was able to pick, because Ten Little Indians was picked before I got there. I did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which was kind of good because it was connected up to the Ken Kesey part of it was connected up to my Grateful Dead longings.
Yes.
And I could, you know, mix up stuff. I thought I really liked the theater. I liked directing. I liked how it integrated a lot of forms. When I was the high school teacher, I had to do the lighting myself. So I had to get a book and teach myself the lighting. And we had two scene preset consoles, no computers then. And I had to run the board while the show was on. And it was fun. I would change the cues in the middle of the show and experiment with different stuff.
Yes.
And, you know, you could do crazy stuff that was very helpful. So when I went to help build this theater, we found a space, we raised money, we put in, you know, we put in a thing, and we had a couple of seasons there, and it was really fun.
How did you know what to do? Or was it just pure instinct? And
I think that because I had been writing the plays and been in some, I don't really ever think of myself as any kind of actor, so that's not something I would ever claim. But I had been in some, I felt like I understood the process pretty well. So I knew how to get from A to Z. But I think the lucky part was that I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
So I sort of made it up. At that point, it was lucky. It was at a point where I could build my own sort of, I didn't, you know, people now talk about your vision, your voice, your tech. That is all baloney. I had no idea about that. I was just making stuff.
Yeah.
And I knew that you had to have lights and I had to get cues from place to place. So I just figured it out. But I didn't, it was very raw. But I built a whole soundtrack for Ten Little Indians that we played live off stage. And I made this very experimental set that was quite weird and had no walls. And it's just what I like doing.
Yeah.
So I messed with all of that stuff. And it was good. It was a good beginning of the training. I think over the long course of a career, there was many other steps that I had to go through next.
Sure.
Which helped. So before getting to the Olympics, this is all before the Olympics, it helped me like just explore my own raw work. And then I started to absorb influences. And absorbing influences is a big part of a good director's career and work.
Or an artist at all.
Yeah.
At this time, who were some of the other influences on you that you were absorbing and starting to identify?
I think that I was very rhythmic because I'm not a musical. I don't play an instrument, but the influences for me were how to make the show mind blowing, or how to have it lift off somewhere in the second act into something interesting or unique, or how to play with poetics. My influences were largely from English, study of English and classics. So it would have been poets and writers and things like that. It wasn't really based on like my knowledge of who great directors were, except who I knew in San Francisco and what shows I would see on tours that would come through there. My first musical that I saw on tour in San Francisco, which I went with my mother, my family, was Hair. Okay. So I was about 11 or 12.
Wow. Right?
Sitting next to my mother at the end of the first act, everyone got naked and started bouncing off a sheet or something. And we all thought that was perfectly normal. And it was completely crazy. And I thought, oh yeah, well, that's fun. And I do remember after the show, seeing some of the actors like leaving the stage door and like clearly pretty happy and heading off to like go have a drink or something. And I remember thinking to myself, well, that looks like fun.
Right. That's
I mean, the culture of that looked fun.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And it's still fun. Still fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you said that the first theater that you had helped create was in San Diego, and you've worked at so many wonderful regional theaters. What do you think a regional theater's responsibility is to the community it inhabits?
Well, the regional theater has meant a lot to me. And I think I was lucky enough to grow up in the United States during a time when there was a very, very vibrant and flourishing regional theater, starting with Zelda Fitzchandler and moving through to a place like ACT in San Francisco. There continue to be, but I think that is more in some threat now. A very, very vibrant regional theater. I always, maybe it's because I was raised Catholic, I don't know, but I think that running a regional theater is a little bit like being a parish priest. Okay. In other words, you have a following, right? The people come to hear the great stories. They share certain ideas and values. They explore who they are as a community. So if I'm running Intimont Theater, I'm working at the Guthrie, there are the 10,000 subscribers that are our parish flock. And we create stories and create seasons to help them explore questions they have either in their community or they have about their history or they have about whatever it is. So like I remember at Intimont, you know, having a letter from a nurse who was an oncology nurse who worked and helped people who were constantly suffering. And she said, you know, Intimont means so much to me because I come there to get regenerated, you know, to pick up, you know, more stories and more of who I am. And it sort of sustains me and restores me to go back to my work. And I think, you know, you have to make decisions for the community you work in, for the questions you're asking yourself. You have to ask all these things and you have to really be observant and thoughtful as a citizen, as a member of a community, as a person who's holding on to stories, asking questions about how we're changing, looking at questions of diversity. I don't see theater as, which some people do, I don't see theater as a means to social change.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah.
There are people who have a very strong view that theater, you know, should incite and transform social change. I don't see that. I think theater, good theater, has to reflect who we are, make us ask difficult questions, but it might do stuff that you're really not going to like and agree with. And it might have to go into areas that are complicated and inspire conversation, but it's not our job to engineer change. It's our job to reflect and ask questions and look at our old stories and look at new stories, but we're not there to change people that way. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I think you can argue that it's going to eventually lead to that. But I find theater, which is sort of beating you over the head with how you're supposed to be or how you're supposed to think, to be very much not what theater does. Mm-hmm. And this may be a division that's emerged more recently in the theater as we know it now between people who see it in both ways. But I don't see theater doing that. I think you have to be able to do absolutely anything in a theater and infuriate and transform and elevate. And you can do the silliest thing and you can do the most profound thing and you can push and ask questions and experiment and do a lot of stuff. But it's not, if you are interested in engineering social change, then you need to go into public policy and make things happen.
Yeah. I love that. When did you head off out of San Diego?
So then from San Diego, I went to the University of, I went to the Olympic Arts Festival. I started absorbing all this Cantor stuff. I was looking at Strehler, who I thought was great. I had spent some time in Europe. I thought Mnuchin was incredible. So I decided I really should get out of the United States. I had a girlfriend at the time who was accepted to the University of Leeds, which was an international program where you could get a Master's of Arts. It wasn't that expensive. So I went with her to Leeds, England, which is in the north of England, which is very unique in the English landscape. That had been the home of a wonderful teacher named Martin Banham, who was the editor of the Cambridge Guide to World Theatre, but specifically known for having a lot of African theatre artists, particularly Wally Schoenka, mm-hmm. who won the Nobel Prize for Literature based on his plays, particularly plays like Death and the King's Horseman. And I took on my studies there to get a master's, concentrating on contour, on directing, and on sub-Saharan African theater. So if you want to have a conversation about the best of sub-Saharan African theater up to 1990, I'm really good at that.
Get this guy to dinner. My gosh.
And there were some extraordinary, you know, because it's a time of colonialization and coming out from under that. And
a lot of
independence. And there's some incredible theater artists that were working at the time. And Schoenka was a particular influence because he had written some incredible books on myth, literature, and the African world, and some other books, and a real thinker about theater, and his plays are so good. And I have directed a couple of his plays since, but I put a good deal of concentration into that and expanding. The thing about Leeds that was great was people were from all over the world. So we had people from, you know, Palestinians from who lived in Beirut. We had Africa, Asia, all over the world, and influences, and very few people actually from England, although a few wonderful artists. And we could study a wide range of approaches and share a lot of ideas. And it got me very much out of my head from an American perspective and point of view. And from there, I could go and see stuff in England. I was able to see a lot of Strehler's work. I could see more European work while I was there and absorb it at the time. That work now is very different in Europe, and we can have a different conversation about how it's changed. But at the time, there were some amazing people to see.
What do you think the big differences are between the American process of storytelling in the theater versus some of the things that you were learning over at Leeds?
You know, I think you might be asking about European. I mean, there are different schools, I think, in Europe. There's someone like Cantor, who's highly experimental, and there's someone like Strehler, who is more of a classicist. You know, he had done incredible Shakespeare, his King Lear, and his Tempest is arguably the greatest production of a Shakespeare anybody ever did in the 20th century. It's so incredible. And you can watch it on television if you want.
Great.
On YouTube. I think it's on YouTube now.
Good to know.
And he was a great influence. Mnuchin was integrating a lot of world culture and a lot of different forms into her work, which now I think she might be criticized for, but at the time was very interesting. So you could see, you know, Indian and Kathakali work. You could see she would integrate a lot of different forms into her work. That was fascinating and interesting. And there were more experimental and incredibly interesting people exploring different ways of thinking about narrative. I think that you have to separate the Europeans from the English, from the Americans, from the, you know, they're not all the same.
Yeah.
And they have different traditions and strains. I think the European audiences are much more open to abstraction and to different ways of breaking down a text and more patience for it. The American audiences are rooted in a kind of reality that they expect of a piece of theater. And because of our tradition of musical theater and things like that, we experiment in a different way from the way the Europeans might. The English are rooted in their traditions of Shakespeare, et cetera. So they come and a great kind of acting tradition, but there are some wonderful experimental artists from there. But I was kind of interested in the whole range of them with a focus on Cantor, who I wrote a full dissertation on. So I was able there to pick up all the writings about his work in English. I was able to explore all of it and just sort of did a deep dive into that. Plus was interested in Strehler. And this, so I moved from my own raw state to a period of really absorbing influences.
And forgive my ignorance, while you were reading and absorbing and writing the dissertation, were you able to create theatrical stories as well? Or was it just, Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I did, for my dissertation piece, I did a lot of directing there. But the one that was probably most significant was I did my own adaptation of Thomas Hardy's short story, The Withered Arm, which is a very strange piece. And I'm sure, I don't know if anyone will ever do that. my designer was from China, and he was extraordinarily interesting. All my actors from all over. And I built this very unique piece. It gave me a chance to really experiment, where I was playing with ideas I was thinking about from Cantor, some more traditional ideas. I'd taken this English text, I did the adapting myself, I'd done my own kind of writing, and pulled all that together. I also did a play of Shoyinka's called The Strong Breed, which was very strange and weird and super fun. And so I was able to explore a lot of stuff that you wouldn't normally be finding in a graduate school now or in things like that. And I was helpful in doing lighting for other people's work and helping my fellow students do stuff. And we were having conversations, and we had very intense conversations. I had a friend, Maisha Maponya, who is a wonderful writer from South Africa, and they were in the middle of apartheid at the time. This is before Nelson Mandela got out. He was very radical. He brought a couple of his friends from South Africa, and they did some very radical work, which I think if people did now, they would all freak out about. Yeah. But it was really good and interesting and very radical and politically radical. And we had, you know, students from, you know, I had one really good friend who was from Beirut, and she was Palestinian, and she had a very unique perspective. And you could mix that with the people from Japan or from, so it was a really good place to kind of cross-pollinate and take in influences and ideas.
Do you feel that radicalism has decreased in terms of storytelling in the theater?
No, I don't. I mean, I think it's just different. I think each generation has its own people who push the envelope. If you liked slave play, it was radical in its way. Mm-hmm. I don't like to make judgments like that, because I think each generation has to find its own vocabulary.
I love that.
You know, but Jeremy's a wonderful artist, mm-hmm. and Robert Harrow's really interesting. There are people, you know, like Elevator Repair Service, who might do interesting mm-hmm. stuff there. Mm-hmm. People who come in from, you know, off the radar. You never know where those influences are going to come from or where they're going to seep up. In Europe now, Ostermeyer is very strong, working out of Berlin. There are other radical artists working in opera as well. I tend to be more in the middle. I don't push it as much. And there's a different diet for all of that stuff.
Yeah. What makes a ideal collaboration for you? Or what elements are necessary for a successful collaboration in storytelling?
I think that the more I've done this, the more I realize it's not that, it's not that you work out, I see the piece this way and I'm going to make this thing. Mm-hmm. I think instead an ideal collaboration, and I've been lucky to work with some incredible designers for a long period of time. It's the ability to start with a set of ideas and really have a process with the actors, with the designers, which deeply explores the piece. So in the best of all possible worlds, everything you started the piece with may indeed be the opposite of what you thought when you got to the end. Mm. You know, you have to be agile and exploring and willing to ask different questions that you can change all of your assumptions when you get there. So if I start something like My Fair Lady, which had a fairly rigorous and long, you know, process to develop a set for the Beaumont like that, I would be able to tell you that I did not know how it was going to end when I started rehearsal.
Got it.
That I knew that I was going to be building something, build that with Lauren. And when we got there, I mean, I knew she wasn't staying, but I didn't really know much more than that. And really felt like you had to explore. And now when you may learn things at the end, that mean you have to go all the way back to the beginning and go through it again. But I think the bigger burden that goes, a great director is the best leader of the process and opening up the process. He or she does not have to be the person that knows what's going to happen or are imposing their vision on everybody. Their process may have a vision of its own, which is because of the way they look at things, and they have to make decisions and edit and push, but it's not about something pouring out of your head. Mm-hmm. It could be you know, the painter had, you know, puts all the pots on the ground and they start to go through and build up something, or the principles that de Kooning would use to build his abstractions, he would be exploring different things with each one of them, and the pots may make who knows what they're going to make.
Yeah. Could you walk us through your process? So let's, if we could take My Fair Lady as an example, it comes to you or you come to it and go, yes, I'm going to tell this story. What then happens next for you?
Pieces come to you in lots of different ways. Some come because you want to do them and you, mm-hmm. you're like, oh my God, I got to do Hamlet now. And some come because I had been in the process with My Fair Lady for a new number of years where we were going to do it on Broadway and we were going to do it with these actors. And then eventually no one could afford it on Broadway. I brought it with Susan Bristow and the Niederlanders to Lincoln Center. And then we decided, yes, we could do it here. So that's a more complicated part. And it came when it was ready to happen. Mm-hmm. A piece like that, you have to immerse yourself first in Pygmalion, the mm-hmm. original writing. What are the core values of what Shaw's exploring? Why was he exploring it the way he was in 1911? What was he after? And then the next big influence was 1938. There was a film that Leslie Nielsen made with Wendy Hiller that was written by Shaw, in which he'd rewritten certain parts of it. That film is so good. You can also watch that on YouTube if you want. And it was a huge influence. From that film, a man named Pascal got the rights to make the musical. And he went to many different people where he, and the ending we know of in the musical sort of starts with a changed ending that Shaw didn't want to happen, that the Hollywood producers made him put on.
Happy.
Of course. Of course.
And you have to understand why Shaw was obsessed with not having a happy ending, with undermining the principles of the rom-com and of like asking different kinds of questions. So you take that and then you get to the musical itself and you look at the film, you look at the original script, you look at that carefully, and then you start to build through the kind of production history. So in the case of something like My Fair Lady, it had become, because of Rex Harrison, somehow this vehicle for older actors, you know, to have a chance to torture younger actresses.
Right.
And that actually, if you understand Pygmalion, is not the story. Mm. So as I started, one of the keys to looking at new ways of interpreting it was coming upon, you know, Harry Haddon Payton's amazing ability, a younger looking at Higgins in a much different way, actually getting in underneath the conditions that Eliza Doolittle was living in, what her father was really like, where the radicalism in Shaw's ideas were against the dramatic structure that he built. And so the casting went into reassessing what those rules were, because you kind of get a Higgins who's a little bit on the spectrum.
Yeah.
You know, and who is a little closer to Shaw, I think. And then suddenly all the text starts to change because you don't right. have this kind of misogyny. You have a person with a problem.
Right.
And then you start. So again, the process does go into that kind of questioning all the way through, particularly in a revival. If it was something like South Pacific, you know, had a lot to do with the position of race, how Nellie Forbes changed, who she was, and asking questions about what really was going on in 1949. And then looking at it now, because the production had taken on a lot of other weird weight that wasn't really true of the show. So I do that kind of investigating particularly with a revival. Now that's going to be different in the case of making something new where you're actually guiding, you're guiding the building of an actual piece. And, you know, how you ask questions about that piece. And I, you know, those things is a little bit a kind of a different chemistry to how that all unfolds.
And do you like to collaborate with a writer on a new piece? I mean, if they're workshopping it all and then you're the director associated, will you sort of help guide and say, what about storytelling in this section? What about, can we clear this up a little bit?
I have a very distinct approach to this, which is I don't believe in being like the play doctor and making them write the piece I want to write. I think what I would say is, if I was doing the workshop of a new play, I probably would have nothing to say about it through the whole first workshop. I would just be trying to make work what is there.
Mm-hmm.
and exploring it. In the same way, what do you learn if you've done Shakespeare, and I've luckily done over 20 of them and many of them several times, is that there was no workshop process in 1593, okay? And there's a lot of weird dead ends those plays go down. And so the interpreter has this very big job to put together these very complex works. And the muscularity it takes to ask those questions means some other stuff comes up that you figure out about the piece. Whereas if you enter a piece thinking you're going to fix it, and you can make the writer change it any way you want, you're going to miss the things you didn't make yourself do by asking harder questions about why it's structured the way it is. And so I will often take a lot of time before I say, to where I'm like, I've worked on the scene now four times. I can't get it to work. You guys got to go work on it. Okay. Or this makes sense or it doesn't. And so the process may take longer and may take longer to and finding what that larger rhythm of it is does take a lot of time. And you don't always know as you're doing it. Now, if you have someone like Adam Gettle and you're working on Light in the Piazza, he has a very deep sense of the music and what he wants to write. So you're always bouncing against that. And in that case, a lot of that was about the issue of when you learn certain information and how that evolved and building a mise-en-scene which would release the sound in the piece. And that took its own time.
Good morning, Mama. Liza, darling. We've got to help the boys at Behind the Curtain. Oh, Broadway's living legends. Oh, it's marvelous. Well, what would they like? Some cream of wheat? No, Mama, they want some money. Money? Well, let's send them a great big bag of money. No, all you have to do is go to patreon.com. You know, it's patreon.com. And you set up a monthly donation. Money makes a world go around, Mama. Oh, don't I know. Patreon.com. Do it now.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUPSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
What is the first day of rehearsal like for you? Does it change based on project to project? Or is there a certain set of traditions that you always like to bring in on the first day of rehearsal?
I mean, I would always say there's three terrible days in every process. First day of rehearsal, first run through, and first preview.
Yes.
Yep. Yep.
They're always absolutely terrible. And I prepare everybody for that. So people are nervous. People are nervous on first day. You do your speech. Nobody knows each other. I want to do as dry and raw a reading the first time without any information as possible. Because again, you might learn something by what you don't know as the piece unfolds in a first reading that you couldn't learn any other way.
And when you say dry and raw, does that mean, okay, everyone just read the dialogue in a very clinical fashion, or?
No, I give no instructions whatsoever.
No instructions. Oh, great.
Yeah.
So, just read and
free for all. Yeah.
Yeah. Because immediately you get into this kind of cognitive problem of them trying to read it the way they think I want it.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to what you might discover by reading it the way it comes to you, and you might learn something that you don't. What I think I want is always, it'd be lovely to be brilliant enough to know exactly what I want when I start. But that's, as I said, I'm setting a process in motion. So one of the keys is to be open to accident, chance, ideas that you didn't expect, and how to integrate them into something you're building. Mm-hmm. So one of those places is the first read through. You may have something happen, or you may learn something that you absolutely didn't expect. You may absolutely hate. You may go, oh my God, how am I going to get this? Some people may, you know, you'll find, you know, my daughter is dyslexic. And I remember in a very early, when I was assisting Robert Woodruff on something, we had an actor who was dyslexic. Mm-hmm. And he said so beforehand. The first read through was his nightmare.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So, yeah. Oh yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So, you know, that's its own thing in terms of changing the rhythm of the piece. So,
and the research that you've accumulated throughout your pre-production process, do you share that all on the first day? Does it come out as necessary as you're crafting a scene? How do you go about informing people of the actual world of the play?
Yeah, usually my associate, and I've had great associates, you know, work with me, will build a Bible of all the research that we have available to everybody. Because mm-hmm. I think everybody needs to know what everybody else knows.
Yeah.
I'm not there to like say, oh, now is the perfect time to give him this. I'm not quite
You've
that
reached
way.
The next level.
Yes, exactly. Whereas the person may go off and be reading all of that and then come into a scene going, but I learned this and this and this. I'll be like, okay, let's explore that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then table work? Yes, no?
I do table work, yes. I do table work. The table work for me is not, sometimes it may be, you know, in the case of Shakespeare, it's going to be, having worked with Peter Hall, it's going to be about like applying an approach to the verse. It's going to be that kind of table work. And it's asking the questions of what is the world? What is going on in this, you know, basic stuff. It's not result oriented. I'm not, you know, it's lining up the questions we're going to ask. It's answering things about the world we need to know. It's finding out things we didn't expect. It's not trying to control. It's not trying to control the world of the piece. Mm-hmm. It's not trying to control the actors. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes. So then when you start to put a scene up onto its feet, do you have in your mind a predetermined idea of, I know they're going to move here, they're going to move there? Or how does that begin? The actors are ready, yeah. You're ready?
The key is not, I'm going to get them to move here to there. The key that would have been in your preparation is your building machine that's going to operate the play. Okay?
Yep.
You've built something. Now, what a lot of that goes into is floor plan. Okay, so floor plan, if it's a conventional play with a living room, the floor plan becomes everything. Where's the door? How far is the door? Where is the drink cart? Where is this? Where is that? And you're building a life in a naturalistic context there, as opposed to, you know, if you take something like My Fair Lady, you have both kind of plastic worlds there. You have the realistic world of the study, which I made highly realistic. It turned mm-hmm. it. You could go from room to room, climb all over it, versus the slightly more abstract world of Covent Garden and places like that. And you're playing in all of that different stuff. And you're setting up a world. Now, one of the principles of Tadeusz Kantor that I apply most rigorously is that every work of art has its own autonomous logic. So that means that this world of this piece has this logic, and I set up a set, and I set up clothes, and I set up language, and I build a logic with that group of artists around that thing. And I can mess with my own rules and my own logic any way I want. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you get to The King and I, and you get to the end of The King and I, and one of the hardest scenes in The King and I is everything has been inside the palace, and then suddenly in the second act, there's this weird, you know, March of the Elephant King that happens outside the palace gates, and you have to go to a whole new location. Well, in the Cantor world, what I did there was totally abstract that, lifted the wall out, made it this crazy thing, and it gave me the permission to build my own logic for how to do that, rather than what Rodgers and Hammerstein tried to do, was apparently get an actual elephant and make it a big thing.
Oh.
I did none of that. I saw that in that, having follow the rules up to one point, once you shift the rules, you then get to other poetic information may come out of it. And you start to play with your own vocabulary over time, the way you would a piece of music, the way you would anything else. So repetition, change of space, change of vocabulary. So that version at the end was almost, they came out in very pure lines. They like kneeled down. We had these weird alleyways, and it was highly abstracted, mm-hmm. very fun to make. completely different than everything else in the play, and exactly when the play started to turn to its tragic corner. Now, that would be how I would be messing with all of these rules. Did I know I was going to do that at the beginning? No. But do I look for that everywhere, occasionally in the second act? Yes.
Yeah.
Do I look for where that liftoff point is into the poetics of the piece? Yes. Mm-hmm. Do you, where are the good places for that? Who knows? Mm.
And is that something you share with the cast? Do you talk about those moments with them?
Or I talk
do you
about sort of... all of it. Yeah.
Okay.
We talk about everything. They are sharing the logic with me, and we are building the logic together.
And is conflict healthy in a rehearsal hall? If you say blah, 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 and the actor says, no, that's not what I was thinking. Are you okay having that discussion be in a public forum?
Conflict is always good.
On stage and
I don't
stage.
Think, yeah, I, no, I mean, I don't yeah. think, I don't think we should be making rules about a person shouldn't, if a person gets upset and they really want to defend something, it's my job to come to them to figure out what they're working out.
Yeah.
It's my job to actually allow them to go through that in their process. It's not my job to judge them and shame them and push them into a place where they're going to put that down and not do it because they're worried about being angry. You know, I did Joe Turner's Come and Gone, and I'm, you know, it's a August Wilson play, and I had an incredible cast, and we had very intense discussions about that world in which we really went at that. And that's a rigorous conversation. And the same thing is true in any rehearsal room. You never know where those are going to be. You're going to have emotional and complicated things, and you have to be willing to go all the way through the conversation.
When you have actors in an audition situation, you know, I know there's talent and all of that, but what are some things that you look for in actors that you want to collaborate with?
Yeah, I look for good collaborators. I look for smart people. I will give them direction, and they don't have to get it right. But if they show me something really interesting because they think in a really good way, that's helpful. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's, I think the audition process is as exploratory as the rest of the process. Mm. And it's, you have to use it to explore the play or the musical. You have to use it to build a company. You have to ask, you have to put actors through their paces. And even if I'm not going to use somebody or I find out early on, I think it's helpful to always give direction, to always be sympathetic and understanding of their preparation, and to work through the work with them.
Your note sessions, how do you prefer to administer notes? A large group setting, individualized?
Always large groups.
So everybody knows the same information.
And so that we have conversations that are fun. Mm-hmm. And we get to that and go, yeah, we learned this and this and this. And it's an extension of the continuation of that process that starts with the audition room, the first rehearsal, the questions you ask in table work, the questions you ask on your feet as you're shaping something. You know, we didn't go into, but when you start to build the world of shaping it, that will also be related to thrust, proscenium. I'm in some alternate space, but constantly we're always having a conversation about the building of the logic of the piece all the way to the end. Mm-hmm. With everybody.
For yourself, is there a note to yourself that you keep giving to yourself to remind you of something throughout your process?
I think no. I think if I can help explain this, it's a verb, you know, it's an active process. It's a becoming. It's not a being. It's not a fixed set of rules. So each piece has its own law. If it has its own logic, it has its own process.
Yeah.
And the key is how to keep moving, staying creative and transformative within each process, and not make every, you know, so you may not know, like if you work at the Met, my first opera at the Met, right? And I call working on opera like paint bucket lighting, paint bucket directing, because, you know, I did Barbara Seville at the Metropolitan Opera, and I was like, oh my God, I'm at the Metropolitan Opera, I'm doing this thing. Well, it's 2.5 weeks of rehearsal. Okay. Not everybody there all the time. 7 days on stage. 4 of those days, the conductor's in charge. Oh. So you basically don't get to get up or down. You just kind of run it. They do, you know, they do it. Then a dress rehearsal, and then you open.
Oh my. Okay.
So,
okay.
So it's really mostly moving people and places, it seems.
Well, so I was like, but I kept us exploring all the way through, right? Good. And I had to get the singers who were much more experienced with all the parts than I was, you know, to on the logic of what this piece was going to be, so that it was alive and active and transformative through that. Mm-hmm. And you're going really fast. Mm-hmm. You're literally running up on, and you know, tech rehearsal at the Met is from 11 to 3.
Oh,
because they're doing at night.
You're right. Yeah.
Another show at night.
You're in very over the set.
Union, very strict union guidelines. And between 11 and 3, there's at least a half an hour break. So you are going fast. The important thing about that is, like, not to go, oh my God, this is terrible, but to go, okay, here are the rules. Let's go.
Let's do it. Yeah. Let's make it
fast. Let's see how quickly we can go. Let's keep it operating and let's go from there. Not, oh my God, this place is terrible. I'll never get this done.
Right. Right.
I like that. Does opening night signify for you that there, you cannot go back in and keep developing a text or keep developing a story? If it's an ongoing process, does that process have to stop at some point?
Well, we haven't gotten all the way through the process. So if you've done, you know, rehearsal, you've done, you know, your tech, and then you start your previews. Remember that other third terrible day? Okay. Then you were going to previews, which is probably the most important part, right? And in the preview process, when you're working during the day, you're doing the deepest, like, editing, shaping, changing, newest idea. And if that process goes well and you're ready by the time the press comes in, you shouldn't have more to do when you get to opening. Mm-hmm. The actors have a new job now, which is to keep exploring the piece. And with I may come in and give notes, because their deepening work now takes over. That I like to do, like, all of the shape of the piece allows the actors to deepen but not broaden their work.
Mm.
So they can get so. And Stanislavski used to say, you know, it takes 100 performances to know if something's really good, what a piece is really like. So I remember when I did Awake and Sing, and I had one of the great casts of my whole life. And I think it was Mark Ruffalo, you know, we would talk about the 100. You know, the 100 performance rule. That show just got better and better and better. It was like an incredible piece of theater with 100 performances. Exciting. So often, you know, we're always hugely envious of these European, you know, companies and performances. But in at least certainly in the time, you know, when Mnuchin and Kanter were coming over, they had their 100 performances. They had been doing these pieces for a long time. They get really rich and really good with that time, or they worked on them for 2 years and then they put them up and then they've been running them all over the world for another two. And that can be pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And Golden Boy and Awake and Sing, what is your particular affinity for Odets?
You know, Jewish radical, great language and extraordinary New York stories. I mean, I had a great, great affinity for them. I think Awake and Sing is one of the great American plays ever written. And I think, I mean, I love Golden Boy too, but the kind of places that raw young playwright went were very, very profound and very great. With that company was extremely special. And that was highly Cantorized show in terms of the way I stripped it and transformed it into a poetic space by the end was very satisfying for me.
That's great. I would like to ask you about Garland Wright, and how that relationship came to be, and what lessons from him do you still take into your process today?
Yeah, well, there's a step that we didn't cover when we were moving. So I went from raw to influences, and then you moved to sort of models and mentors, right? So for me, that was Robert Woodruff first. Mm-hmm. Who I worked with in La Jolla and at the Guthrie and in Los Angeles on several shows. He's really one of the great directors in American theater for the last 50 years. Great experimental director, took enormous chances, really did radical stuff. And he opened me up to a process that was very chaotic and very fun, and he could change anything on a dime. And from that, I went to working with Garland, and Garland was the opposite. Garland was deeply rigorous, extremely classical in nature, incredible visual skill. And I was suddenly at the Guthrie with a company, and we were doing the classics, and I was introduced to Shakespeare. And so I went from this kind of experimental stuff, African theater and Cantor and all that. Suddenly I was being immersed in the classics. And the classics meant Moliere, and it meant De Musset. It meant the Greeks. It meant, and we had a company, and Garland was, and we were at the Guthrie, which was on a thrust. So it took me 2 years of assisting Garland working on a thrust before I started to really realize how the rules of that space worked. Mm. And, you know, I would, you know, it's a great observing process, but how the upstage feeds the downstage, how you move people in space, where, you know, what rules are for that. And he was incredibly good at it.
Right.
And it then makes you really rigorous about your thinking of any space. You're always asking the same kind of questions in any space you go. And had I not had Garland in my life to introduce me and lift my work, I certainly wouldn't be the artist I am now. And he was so devoted at a time when the regional theater was ambitious to have a company to do a certain level of work, to raise the money to do it, to set certain values in place. It was pretty incredible what he was trying to accomplish. I wouldn't know if that's happening anywhere else in the United States now. And, but he, I was very lucky. And we also had a great company of actors. I would set up whole workshops. We would do, you know, mask work, and we would do, you know, Indian dance work, and we would do acting, and we would do so many things to keep building that company. And, it, you know, the work was in the, you know, the proof of the pudding was in the eating.
Yeah.
We had great work that we did. And that influence was huge for me. And I was there 5 years of my life. When I set off from there thinking I had to go off and make my own work. And I did from that what I call the Willy Loman World Tour, where I went from regional theater to regional theater.
Said yes,
just
yes,
working
yes.
Everywhere yeah. for every kind of, you know, and I did lots of Shakespeare and lots of stuff. And then eventually took over a theater of my own. So,
and how did that theater of your own come to be? How did Seattle find you? Did you find them?
Well, I had interviewed for a couple of artistic director jobs, which I either didn't get or wasn't sure I should do. But when Intimont came along, partly it was because Laura Penn was the managing director, and she became a very good friend, and she runs SDC now.
She's amazing.
And yeah, the two of us could really. I went and saw the space. I love the space. It's a modified thrust. It was perfect size. The budget issues were always what they were. They were complicated, but it became a place I could build a body of work. And so I was able to move there and have start a family, and it was the right time for me. Mm-hmm. And it was a good development. I think it's another thing now where you think some of the younger directors would benefit from the chance to have their own theaters, but those opportunities aren't as available as they might have been.
What makes a strong artistic director? Or what advice would you give someone who is about to become an artistic director?
Well, again, you have to love and protect artists, and you have to be willing. You have to be generous. You have to be generous about your work and about other people's work. And you have to be willing to take in all kinds of voices. And because I grew up in the regional theater, I grew up when also we changed as a culture, when we asked questions, you know, in the 90s about race and about casting and about inclusion and about, and those questions have been going on for a long time. They're not new questions. Yeah. And when we tried to look at the world, you know, the same with, you know, LGBTQ questions, all of that was all coming through the work. And the theater can reflect that, and that parish priest quality that I see in a good artistic director is one who can absorb all the new, can guide people, can really create a home for artists to be able to do their best work, no matter how much they piss everybody off.
What do you think your greatest accomplishment was when your tenure was complete over there?
When I left the theater, there was an endowment and no deficit.
Oh, my God.
It didn't last long,
no.
But that's how I left it. we did a great range of work with a great range of artists. And I think our audiences were deeply connected to a theater, having a conversation in a community with the country, with the nation, with democracy, with all those questions that go into who we are. And we, you know, so we would do everything from, you know, Chekhov to Shakespeare, to Lorraine Hansberry to, you know, we did all the work that was a the part of the story of being an American. And that story's changing. So that's all. And we did new works. We did all of that. But I think our community felt like we were a place where you would go to understand a little bit better about yourself.
Would you want to return to that position at some point? Not necessarily at that theater, but being an artistic director again?
I think it's a great calling. I think it has a very profound, as they would say in Catholic school, apostolic mission. You know, it's your way of, it's an important thing to do. And if I were called again and it was the right conditions, I would be honored to be able to do it again. I mean, I try to help Andre Bishop at Lincoln Center, but he's maybe one of the greatest artistic directors ever. He's got deep wisdom, cares about artists. He asks the hardest questions. He guides the institution with incredible care and bravery. And, you know, that kind of clarity is hard to find and a very special quality. Mm.
And in this current climate, what kind of stories do you want to be telling next? Is there anything that's, I don't want to say a dream project, but is there anything right now that you feel this needs to be told in 2020? Maybe it hasn't even been written yet.
2021.
Or 2021. Yeah.
I'm always, you know, I think one of the things about being, you know, having the brakes put on the culture and everybody being like shoved into their house and the doors all locked is that it's a really interesting time to ask yourself about the future. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a really interesting time to say, like, what kind of theater are we going to be making? And what would be the, you know, what would be the next place for who I am in my work? I think one of the bigger questions is how we create the ability for theater to help people deal with complexity, strife. You know, we live in so much of a worse place than we did when I was first growing up in the culture. And I grew up in the 60s and 70s in San Francisco where there were riots right. In the streets.
Yeah, crazy.
So the one thing that theater can do is help you keep two thoughts in your head at the same time. And they don't have to agree with each other.
Right.
And the more balanced and the more complex our thinking can be and the more shared the narrative is, the healthier the culture gets. Because right now, the problem in our culture is that the narrative is not shared. It's all siloed. Mm-hmm. It's all siloed into different sources of information and different everything else. And that's my biggest worry about any stories happening now is how to get the narrative shared. So what was beautiful about doing To Kill a Mockingbird is it's not everybody's story and everybody's going to have a lot of differences of opinion about it. And yes, it was written in 1960, but when we did it at Madison Square Garden and there was 19,000 students there and they were almost all people of color, they could see it as a part of their past, whether they agreed with it as a piece of writing or not, and participate in that story as a group
right. And
as a family for part of their history and what was different about then, who they were now, and how they were moving forward. And I think when the theater is able to do that, it's doing its job. So I look at something like Slave Play, which I think is a very wonderful piece of writing, and you see someone like Jeremy pushing us ahead. There's so many good young writers pushing us ahead. Mm-hmm. You know, Ming Pfeiffer, Sylvia Corey, right? All different ones who are really asking difficult questions and great young directors, you know, who are asking hard questions. When they're at trying to find a narrative that holds us all together, it can be very remarkable. Mm-hmm.
And our last question for you is, if you could talk to the young man who's about to start directing 10 Little Indians at what you know now, what would you say to them? What piece of advice would you pass on to that young person?
Oh my God. I so don't think like that. I would be likely to, eat properly and, all of those shows went really well for me because I didn't really have in my expectations, like a good or a bad. I don't think that the idea of this being good or this being bad is a very helpful distinction. It's a false dichotomy. I would probably be impressed that I still share with that person the same level of optimism and exploration that I have now.
That's
beautiful. That's wonderful.
This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time out. I feel like we got our own private masterclass, so I appreciate that. But thank you.
You know, I appreciate it. I hope that was helpful.
It was splendid. Absolutely terrific.
Incredibly helpful. Incredibly helpful.
Yeah, it's a lot more complicated to talk about directing and what goes into the mechanics of directing. And that may be another podcast because
it could be. Yeah.
This has been awesome. Seriously. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys. I hope it was helpful.
It was fantastic. Take care. Please stay safe. Stay healthy.
Okay. Right, take care.
Thank you for listening to today's episode, and a big thanks to the punchy players Jeff Marquis, who is bringing back Lucy, Betty, Judy, and Morda shill for us.
And a big thanks to our sound editor Daniel Schwartzberg and social media manager Bethany Ann Selecki.
And don't forget, we want more folks to hear these incredible stories, and that's where you come in.
In order for people to find out about us, we need lots of ratings on iTunes. So head on over to iTunes, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, click on our logo, click on ratings and reviews, then write a review and leave us 5 stars and make us feel as special as Eliza Doolittle on Eliza Doolittle Day.
Or you can leave us just 1 star and you can make us feel as bad as Annie did in that really weird production in Boston where Annie dreamt that she was being adopted, but then she ended up back where in the orphanage, right back where she started. Yeah, true story. Rob saw it.
Yes, and it was Betty. It was bizarre. I was there. I was.
Oh, God.
So head on over to iTunes and make us feel even more special than we already do.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard. So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.